integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point?
My name is James Wyrick, and this is Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who protect our nation.
I know I'm asking a lot of you right now, but I ask you to trust the leadership of the Marine Corps to take action and correct this problem. I ask you to trust me personally as your commandant. And when I say I'm outraged that many of you haven't been given the same respect when you earn the title Marine. To the men in our Corps serving today and those who no longer wear the uniform, you're still Marines. I need you to ask yourselves, how much more do the females of our Corps have to do to be accepted? I'm committed to making this right, and I need all Marines equally committed. We all have to commit to getting rid of this perversion to our culture. Enough is enough.
Three-year-old Erica Butner speaking out earlier this week, saying she's one of the victims of the Marines' photo scandal on Facebook.
As a Marine Corps veteran, I am disheartened and disgusted with this scandal.
The offending site is called Marines United, a private Facebook group which posts hundreds of photos of active and retired female service members. Some of the photos show the women naked. The group has 30,000 members. Now, the photos are posted without the women's consent, sometimes listing their names, ranks, and social media handles.
Welcome back to Military Justice. Thanks for being here. Today we are very fortunate to be joined by Elliot Ackerman. He's a former infantry Marine, MARSOC Marine, Special Forces guy, and now he's an author and a reporter. He recently wrote a great article for Esquire on the recent developments in the Marines United case. As you might remember, that was the case of Marines in a Facebook group posting nude photos of fellow female Marines. And there's been some recent developments in these cases. On 29 June 2017, a Marine was sentenced. This is the first Marine who's been brought to trial or had any punishment resulting from the Marines United scandal. So this Marine was sentenced to 10 days confinement, reduction in rank by 3 grades, and forfeiture of 2/3 pay for 1 month. That's according to a Marine Corps news release. And they didn't give any other details. It wasn't open to the public because, quote, summary court-martial proceedings are considered administrative in nature. And so the identity of the Marine is not releasable per the Privacy Act, unquote. That's debatable. That's gone back and forth. I've seen it both ways. But to give you some background on a summary court-martial. In the military, there are 3 different types of courts-martial. There's the summary, the lowest level. Special court-martial, that would be the equivalent of a misdemeanor. And a general court-martial, which is a felony. And if you can hear in the background a little bit of snoring, sorry about that, but I couldn't get Uber producer Dreadnought to leave the room for this recording. So if you hear a bit of bulldog snoring, that's what that is. So a summary court-martial, it consists of 1 military member as the judge. It's usually a judge advocate. It doesn't have to be a judge advocate or a JAG. I have sat as a summary court-martial officer. So that summary court-martial officer serves as the finder of fact and also metes out the punishment. Summary court-martial is in between non-judicial punishment, which is purely administrative, somewhere in between there and a special court-martial, which is truly criminal. Summary court-martial isn't a criminal proceeding. So this Marine that shared nude, or we don't know exactly what he or she did, but presumably shared revenge porn and or made degrading comments or threats to female Marines. And again, we don't know this because this did not go to a court-martial. So I can only guess about what the actual conduct was. And I think this gives you some view of what level of punishment the Marine Corps believes is appropriate. If we do get any more information on this, I will give you an update. But just so you know, this is a summary court-martial, an administrative proceeding, not criminal. It won't go on this Marine's criminal record. It's likely that the Marine would probably be separated, administratively separated, fired from the Marine Corps. And now I'm going to introduce you to Elliot Ackerman. I just picked up his book, or his latest book. He's written two, and he has another one in the pipeline. And I read this last one in about a day and a half. Dark at the Crossing. It's really good. It's about a... wait a second. He explains it better. So with no further ado, or any ado at all, Elliot Ackerman. Elliot, thank you for joining us. How are you this morning?
Good. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Or possibly this afternoon. I know that you're on the other side of the globe.
Yes, it is afternoon for me.
So tell us, how'd you get started in the Marine Corps?
I was a Marine officer and was a product of ROTC. So I went to college at Tufts University and did Naval ROTC there, and then was commissioned a second lieutenant in 2003, which was sort of a, you know, obviously like an interesting year to be coming into the Marine Corps with the invasion of Iraq that spring. So that was sort of my entryway into the Corps. And then I served with 1st Battalion, 8th Marines for 3 years. And then I served with in Marine Special Operations Command in what is now 2nd Raider Battalion as a team leader for another 3 years.
And so you were early there.
Yes, I was quite early there.
I mean, that's about the creation time of that organization.
You know, it was. I was there for the creation. The Marine Special Operations Company I deployed with, we were the very first ones to deploy with organized into teams. So before that, there had been a totally different organization. Now the team concept is how everyone deploys in MARSOC by and large, or at least it's the core unit within MARSOC. And, you know, we were sort of the guinea pigs of doing that in Afghanistan in 2008 was when we finally deployed. But I showed up there right at the beginning of 2007. So the command had only been set up for about 6 months.
Did you ever serve with Fred Galvin?
I didn't serve with him, but I know who he is. He was with... Fox Company, and so I was with Hotel Company, which is basically two deployments later.
Oh, great. Yeah, I've spent a lot of time with Fred. I went out and interviewed him for a while last fall. Well, so what have you been doing in your post-Marine Corps career?
I write full-time these days, so I do lots of journalism, and I also write novels. I've had two books out. I've got a third coming out in the fall of 2018. And I write for places like The New Yorker, Esquire, The Daily Beast, or in The Atlantic, or places where I'm a pretty frequent contributor.
You got another one coming out that soon?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things in publishing is there's, you know, it takes about 18 months to even get a book out. So there's always sort of a backlog as you're working. So I've got a novel, you know, relatively short novel that will be out in 2018.
Is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everybody. Blue Apron achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. I just made Blue Apron last night. It was pasta and chicken and peppers and zucchinis and capers. I would have never used capers before, but with Blue Apron, You definitely use all these new ingredients. It's easy to do. It comes with all the fresh ingredients you'll need to make the meal. I don't think I've ever taken more than an hour, and most of them are around 30 to 40 minutes to prepare. Last night's took about that time, and it's fantastic. It's easy. Sometimes people ask me about this, or they have the idea that Blue Apron might be frozen dinners. Nothing could be further from the truth. Last night it had peppers and capers and lemons and fresh chicken breasts and pasta. So nothing's frozen. It's not pre-prepared. It's just packaged correctly. You get exactly what you need. If the recipe calls for one lemon, you get one lemon. I can't tell you how much that I've loved Blue Apron. I really do. I post sometimes photos of the meals that I make there. So please, check out this week's menu and get your first three meals for free, including free shipping, by going to blueapron.com/military. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/military. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. I just finished, in fact, I want to start talking about Dark at the Crossing. I just finished it not an hour ago. It was a great read.
Thank you. That's generous of you to say. I appreciate that.
Tell me, what kind of research did you do for... So just to give a sketch of Dark at the Crossing, you're telling the story from the point of view of an Iraqi who worked with the U.S. during the war, moves to the U.S., becomes a U.S. citizen, and then goes back to try to fight with ISIS, right?
Right. So, you know, the protagonist's name is Harris Abadi, and he is sort of a man of two identities. You know, he was born in Iraq, but is a naturalized U.S. citizen who worked as an interpreter for the Americans during the war, and he has a lot of conflicted feelings about that experience. And so when you meet him in the opening of the book, he's attempting to cross into Syria from southern Turkey to join the Syrian revolution, a cause he sort of feels to be above reproach. And so the novel is really, it's kind of a story of his journey trying to cross the border. But as he attempts to cross, he doesn't make it very far and is actually mugged in the opening pages of the book and winds up staying in this border town called Antep with a Syrian couple. And their backstory is the husband had been very active in the revolution, and one day there was an explosion in their apartment building while he was out running an errand, and his wife is there with a daughter. And as they're piecing through the rubbles of this explosion, everyone assumes that the wife and daughter are dead, but miraculously they're able to pull his wife from the wreckage and rush her to a hospital across the border where she survives. And when she wakes up, her husband, this Syrian man, basically tells her that, you know, I've seen this explosion. Our daughter's dead. I didn't see her body, but she was trapped in the wreckage. And the wife kind of can't accept that loss. So the wife wants to cross the border to try to see if she can find something of the daughter, and the husband refuses to go. And so when this Iraqi American, who we talked about before, enters into their home, he's trying to cross to go fight, and this couple, sort of the central tension in their marriage is one wants to go return to Syria and one wants to stay on the other side of the border. So the central choice of the book is kind of who crosses, who stays, and why.
I'm trying to piece together from what I know of your background and the writing. I can see that you would draw a lot from your time with an interpreter. And I really love your sketch, the flashbacks to your main protagonist's time with the special forces operator. I think you do a great sketch of him. But where did you, how'd you do all your research for his time back in Michigan, the main protagonist's time back in Michigan?
Yeah, mainly just by knowing and speaking with a number of Iraqis, you know, who I'm you know, friends with or was introduced to, who have come back to the U.S. and sort of, you know, for many of them, obviously it's an emotionally complex decision to immigrate to the U.S. because on the one hand, you know, they're opting into, you know, becoming American citizens. On the other hand, you know, they can sometimes have a complicated relationship with the United States in terms of they don't feel completely at ease with, you know, the particularly amongst for an Iraqi, for the way the U.S. war went in their, you know, country of birth. So there's a sort of innate tension about making that choose to immigrate to the U.S. and potentially naturalize as a U.S. citizen, but it's also something that they want. So I, you know, wanted to try to show some of the complexity of that. And then, you know, and then in terms of the research, you know, the rest of the research, I've lived in Istanbul for a number of years and spent a lot of time in the places that are described in the book in southern Turkey and along the Syrian border, just covering the war as a journalist as well. So I find that my approach when writing a book in terms of research, you know, usually it's pretty immersive. I'll just sort of plop myself down somewhere. And as I'm watching events unfold, oftentimes the shape of a novel will start to kind of emerge for me.
Yeah, you do a great job at that. And I really, I mean, not to say I have a particularly favorite part, but I really enjoyed your sketches of Michigan and that tension of, hey, wait, you know, I fought against the Americans, but kind of with them. And now I'm going to go to America. And you see that with the protagonist throughout the book, kind of deciding if he's going to announce himself as an American.
Right. And I think some of the research, you know, some of it is experiential. I mean, I'm a veteran. So, you know, when this character, Harris Abadi, winds up in Michigan back from the wars, you know, he has this sort of sense of listlessness. You know, he just doesn't feel at home there, even though he, for so long when he was in Iraq, had wanted to be in Michigan. And that sense of listlessness was obviously something that I could identify with, you know, having spent a lot of time in the wars and being deployed, thinking, oh, I can't wait to get home and, you know, and for life to slow down a bit. And then I get, you know, and then you get home and, you know, you miss the deployments and all the intensity and purpose that you have there. So he's definitely a character that I could identify with.
Yeah. Okay. Dark at the Crossing, go read it. I really don't want to spoil any more of it for people, but I can tell you I read it in probably the last 36 hours. It's great. It's surprising. And it's, I mean, as far as the story, it has surprises, so I don't want to wreck it for anybody. So we're here to talk about some of your great reporting. You just reported for Esquire on Marines United, and I concentrate on this show about military justice. But I think you do a great job in that article of focusing on this in a way that other people haven't for this story. This isn't, in my estimation, this isn't an issue that's going to be solved by a criminal charge. A court martial isn't going to change this. So let's get into what you talked about in that story.
Well, the story, it kind of got into, I imagine some of your listeners are familiar with this scandal surrounding Marines United, which broke in early March of this year when a reporter named Thomas Brennan wrote a story for The War Horse, which he co-published with Reveal, which is a website run by the Center for Investigative Journalism. And his story that he wrote got a lot of attention and led to you know, General Neller and others having to testify up on the Hill about not only the Corps' response to this nude photo sharing scandal, but also to how gender integration was working out, you know, in the Marine Corps and amongst all the services. But when the story hit, you know, as I imagine many of your listeners know, you know, the Marine Corps is a very small place. So when I was an infantryman, I was in Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 8th Marines. And I was a second lieutenant and in command of 1st Platoon. Well, Thomas Brennan, the journalist who broke this story, was a private first class small gunner in 3rd Platoon, Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 8th Marines. So I knew Thomas. We had that history together. He and I had sort of been in touch intermittently off and on, and I sort of reached out to him after the story came out to sort of, you know, see how it was going. And as we talked, you know, he kind of let me know that, you know, there was the story he broke, but there was also sort of a story behind that story, which was all of the work he had to do in order to get the story, break it, his interactions with the Marine Corps and his interactions with some of the people who were wrapped up in the Marines United scandal and some of the stuff that had not been reported. So I did a number of interviews with Thomas and interviews with many, many other people to try to get at, you know, the root of what this problem is, which is, I think, what, you know, you allude to, is this is not just something that you're going to be able to, you know, change the UCMJ and punish a few people and then it's just going to go away. I mean, these are really fundamental cultural issues amongst all the services and also within the Marine Corps. And these are issues that go back before Marines United when we talk about gender integration. And I had written on that subject before this scandal broke. So that's kind of where the story came from.
Yeah, and I think you do a great job of capturing the essence of this. I thought this, but it's so verboten to even mention this, that you talk about General Dunford. And I think it's fair to say over the last 20 years, yeah, Dunford and Mattis are our two most revered generals. Mm-hmm. And what Dunford said, what General Dunford said, I think his actions in backing away from integration of women in the infantry, I think that's something that our young Marines will not forget for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And, you know, I think General Dunford is one of the most exceptional and iconic Marine officers to emerge in a generation, you know, him and General Mattis. But this issue of gender integration, I think the way the Marine Corps handled it has been, and this is before Secretary Carter's decision, has been somewhat disingenuous. And what I mean by that is not that they've been lying about anything, but as this decision was being made and the Marine Corps was weighing whether or not it would recommend for full gender integration, the studies that were done and the conversation around it was one that focused solely on physical issues, right? These physical differences between men and women. There was an enormous Marine Corps study about this, pages upon pages about, you know, women's rates of getting shin splints and hip bone densities and things like that. And there was very little conversation about, you know, what are the cultural issues if we're going to integrate something like the infantry, you know, where I'd spent plenty of time, how are we going to have to change the culture of the infantry
right.
to accommodate women? Because the culture that the Marine Corps infantry has, I mean, it works. You know, there's a reason why, you know, 19-year-old lance corporals will charge a machine gun nest or run out into a street in Fallujah that's raked with machine gun fire to shoot off a rocket. You know, the reason they do that is because there is a esprit de corps and a culture that has been fostered in the infantry, and there's a formula there that has really gone unaltered for decades and decades and decades. And people can make the argument, I think this is a totally valid argument, that, hey, that formula works. Why mess with it by adding women into the mix, which will change that formula? Because the central component of it is, you know, there's a lot of hypermasculinity that exists there. But at the moment we were having this debate, you know, there was a very, very real chance that the decision would come from our civilian leadership that the Marine Corps needed to change, that the Marine Corps needed to reflect more the societies of the U.S., which, you know, does not have all male anything anymore, and start to reflect that. And if that decision came down, you know, just in my estimation for an outsider, the debate is no longer about do we or do we not think there should be women in the infantry. It should be about, okay, how do we prepare for either contingency to make sure when we're given our marching orders, we are ready to go and to do this. And it seemed along the way that the Corps' position was to not talk about these cultural issues, to frame it as though these are just physical issues, and to just drag our feet along the way. And obviously, there are physical differences between men and women, but if you've ever spent any time in an infantry battalion, you know, these guys aren't supermen. You know, there's your, you know, your 25 percenters who are not incredibly super fit. You know, I was the body composition officer for 1st Battalion, 8th Marines. I taped and weighed plenty of chubby infantry Marines who were still in the Corps and who went on to fight in Iraq and, you know, do fine. And so there are plenty of women who can meet those standards. But I think that, you know, when we talk about General Dunford and others, when the decision came down, I think, you know, what was a mistake was we didn't see clear messaging from the senior leadership that, all right, we're doing this. This is how we're doing it. This is going to be good for the Corps. And it was sort of like a deafening silence. And into that vacuum of deafening silence, what we saw was Marines United and things like that start to emerge. And I think all of us, and I say it's just myself as a former Marine, you know, I care far less about whether or not, you know, what the decision is. Are we integrating or are we not integrating? I think at this point, though, it's about, you know, we have to not have a black mark on the honor of the Corps. And, you know, this thing has been, it's a black mark now. And that's what I think is sad and regrettable.
I've been struggling with this. I mean, I just got an email from one of my TBS roommates, you know, who's an infantry guy. I have many friends, you know, that were former or even continue to be in the infantry. And this is the issue I have is, like, are those generals is General Dunford being disingenuous, or have they so long been in? And like you were saying, we don't want to mess with this mix that works. And they don't want to change that in any way.
But that's, you know, that's all well and good. But yeah. At the end of the day, you know, as military officers, all military officers serve their civilian masters. And the military represents the society that it comes from. That's how the military works in a democracy. So when the American people speak and elect a leader who has a certain view of how the military should be, this is, you know, this isn't just Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, you know, passing down this edict. It's the American people elect their leaders. Their leaders form policies, and the military adopts those policies. And so there was a time when the service chiefs were all able to make their arguments of what they thought the best way going forward was. The Marine Corps made an argument and recommended that certain MOSs not be integrated. The Secretary of Defense said, we've heard your arguments. However, we're going to order integration. From that moment forward, the job of the service is to do this and do it as well as it possibly can. I mean, it's very black and white to me.
I absolutely
agree
with you.
We're past that point now.
Yeah, and so then when General Dunford says, well, we're still kind of, you know, getting in our last salvo that is, well, we'll do this, but we don't agree with it. And you see that I think the other services handled it so much better.
Yeah, well, and that's when you get up there and say or signal, we'll do this, but we don't agree with it. It gives sanction to every 19-year-old or 20-year-old Lance Corporal, PFC, or frankly, actually, from what I've learned, or officers who are much, much older. I mean, this Marines United thing was not a bunch of 19 or 20-year-olds. This was staff sergeants, you know, majors in some cases.
Yeah, I know there were lieutenant colonels. Yeah,
to take matters into their own hands and to be the silent voice of the Marine Corps. And that's not what the Corps is about.
I absolutely agree with you. And we can only look back, what, 5 or 6 years, we had 1,500 general officers saying that integrating, you know, openly serving homosexuals was going to destroy the military.
Right.
And they've, I can't point to that any, you know, where is there evidence of that when they were so
assured? There is no evidence. And at the end of the day, too, once the decision is made by our civilian masters, you know, you salute and you do it to the absolute best of your ability. And to drag your heels on the issue isn't protecting the organizational equities of the Marine Corps.
Military Justice is brought to you by the good people of ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Do you know where to go to post your jobs to find the best candidates? Well, it's ZipRecruiter. In fact, just this past week, I was at a party talking to a longtime family friend and business owner, and I mentioned that I was just getting sponsored by ZipRecruiter, and she said that she used it and got great candidates through it. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100 plus sites in one click. Then the powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anybody else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of the jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get qualified candidates in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, the listeners of Military Justice can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/military. That's ZipRecruiter.com/military. One more time. To get it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/military. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. It allows this podcast to continue.
I mean, listen, the fact of the matter is, too, and I hope in the article I write, this is coming across, is that 97% of the Marines out there, 98%, this is not a big deal. They're doing their job. You know, when we talk about how it's a small Marine Corps, So I mentioned I was with 1st Battalion, 8th Marines. The 1st Integrated Infantry Battalion is now 1st Battalion, 8th Marines, small Marine Corps. And the battalion commander of 1st Battalion, 8th Marines is my SPC from the basic school.
Yeah.
I know very well, who's a remarkable officer. And speaking with him, you know, the point he was making to me, he said, you know what, Elliot, like, I get there's a lot of noise on this issue. And he said, frankly, my biggest challenge is just cutting off that noise, because in my battalion, you know, everyone is just focused on deploying. This has not been a big deal. And there have been some things that the Marine Corps has done that I think have been very smart, in so much as, you know, a question I had in the lead to this was, like, how are we going to integrate? Are we just going to drop in a handful of females into these infantry battalions, infantry females, and then be surrounded by men? And on the one hand, Corps has done that, and that they are by and large forcing the female infantry Marines to come up through the ranks. But what they're doing is, because the battalions are integrated, is they're making sure that they have mentors who are female mentors who are more senior NCOs, staff NCOs, and officers that are in support billets.
Well, how long?
If that makes sense.
Right.
So for instance, so like the battalion commo is a female.
Yeah, but how long can we go with no female platoon commander?
Well, you know, and this gets back to, you know, we talk about standards. I don't know, and I think eventually women will pass through this course, but, you know, something that's been evident to me is, you know, I went through the infantry officer course in the winter of 2004. And when I went through the course, the sort of, for lack of a better term, the vibe of that course was very much, listen, guys, you all are the first group of platoon commanders who are graduating the basic school since Vietnam, knowing that they're heading into combat. So as much as this has been a tough guy course, you know, with hazing and stuff like that, it's like, you know, we have a bunch of stuff we need to teach you guys how to do. Just basic operational, you all need to know how to lay in your mortars. You all need to know how to run this type of a convoy. You need to know it because you're going to be doing it in combat in about 3.5 months. For instance, all of our events that were graded, hikes and otherwise, were graded as a group. So you passed and failed them as a class. And so the standards at the basic school, at the infantry officer course at the basic school, have actually evolved in the last 3 to 4 years.
You're right.
And I remember speaking with, this is about 3 years ago, right when the first female officers started going through the infantry officer course as a test. And I bumped into the then director of IOC, who was about a year or two senior to me, but we were contemporaries in the infantry. And I'd known him. I was out of the Corps. He was still in the Corps. And I asked him, I said, how's it going, by the way, with the females going through IOC? And he said, oh, you know, it's going fine. And I asked what you just asked me. I said, well, when do you think the first one's going to pass? And he said to me, it's never going to happen.
Yeah, so I know. I was at McCitic at the time. So the working for the 3-star there, that was the issue. Like, that was 5 years ago, and we haven't had one woman pass? Are we waiting for some superwoman?
But this is what he said to me. He said, it's never going to happen. I said, what do you mean it's never going to happen? And he said, I said, the IOC, like, it was physically demanding, but it wasn't the hardest course I ever went through in the Corps. And he said, the curriculum's completely changed now that females are coming through. Now everything is graded individually, individual effort. You know, so you can't tell me there's a female Marine who can pass the CET coming in. And even if they pass the CET, you're not going to see one that passes the heavy weapons march, you know, humping the upper receiver of a Mark 19 for 10 miles. He's like, it's just never going to happen. I kind of asked again. I said, okay, but, you know, I'm sure eventually, you know, some woman who, you know, can pass the CrossFit challenge or is in exceedingly good right. shape will come through and pass. I'm like, what happens then? And he just looked at me and said, never going to happen. Which at that time it was, you know, a little bit disconcerting to me, because I was like, well, if there's no plan to integrate these women when they do pass, what are we going to do? Now, I imagine at this point there probably is a plan. There's also this idea too that the standards had some way morphed to make it specifically more difficult for women to get in. You know, that unsettled me. Like, again, like, that's not what the Corps is about. Like, let's just set the standard for everybody and keep it. I think one of the things that's great about integration at this point was, I think this is a moment to embrace integration too, because great, let's actually just set the standard and say, this is the no BS standard for an infantry Marine, and we're going to stick to it. Because when I was in the grunts, we had plenty of guys who were way below standards, and you couldn't get rid of them.
Oh, yeah.
And for let's just get rid of people across the board who don't make the standards.
For my non-military members listening, tell us about, like you were talking about, that first indoc. What was that event like, and when you went through, and what is it like now?
When I went through the combat endurance test, it was, you know, it's basically run over the majority of a day, maybe 6 hours or so. And it's just sort of almost like a relay race. You're running from event to event. You're navigating through the woods, and you come to a station. And there's someone there you have to, like, you know, grapple with on the ground. And then you come to another station, maybe 2 miles away, and you have to, you know, assemble four different types of machine guns. And you have to do it all in a time limit. You run an obstacle course, and so you're just sort of on your feet, moving, going from challenge to challenge. And you have to complete the whole series of challenges in a certain amount of time to be admitted into the infantry officer course. You know, but I'll say this too. When I went through the infantry officer course, we didn't drop anyone, even people who didn't pass the CET the first time. Back then, they would just let them retake it until they passed.
Right.
And my infantry officer class, you know, we graduated, I believe it was 83 lieutenants. And of those 83, about 6 or 7 were relieved in combat within a year. And it was a complete no surprise who they were. So I think, on the one hand, it's great that the infantry officer course has evolved this way, where there's actually attrition and they're getting rid of people who aren't up to the challenge. But at the same time, I just sort of wonder, are we now going to make IOC as difficult as we can possibly make it, even if we lose lots of good male Marines, just so we never have to admit the one female infantry officer?
Yeah, and I want to make sure that, listen, I think you might underplay how difficult that event was, because, I mean, you're an exceptionally fit guy. But I'll tell you, when I graduated from the basic school, I was very happy that I was going up to Newport, Rhode Island for my MOS school and not sticking around Quantico for that.
But you know, James, I'll tell you this.
But I get your point.
There is a lot of what I would say kind of playing hide the football in this, like with IOC and other, because, you know, I mean, part of the things is when you're at the basic school, right, you never see the guys who are at the infantry officer course because they're not allowed to talk about it, because everything that happens at IOC is supposed to be confidential. And it's sort of the worst kept secret in the Marine Corps. But the second you make these schools a black box, it's sort of who knows what's going on there. And, you know, I've been to a lot of military tough guy schools, I mean, a number of them. And one of the biggest sort of components around these schools is sort of the mystique that when you don't know what happens, you always project something that's far, far more difficult than it actually is. You know, when I was at MARSOC, the joke about the MARSOC INDOC was that, you know, the number one attrition event at the MARSOC INDOC, you know what it was?
What's that?
Just showing up for the INDOC.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Because so many people would be scared off.
And believe me,
and you get there, you know, and then you get there and you're like, okay, I mean, you know, this is, you got to be fit. This is not, you know, you got to do some real hiking and do some real land navigation, and, you know, you're tired, but it's, you know, these aren't supermen. All the people, all these infantry officers, they're regular guys. All these special operators, they are regular guys.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you as far as what we're talking about, but when you say regular guys, they're pretty damn fit guys. But
they're fit guys, but they're not, you know,
I agree with you,
supermen.
And I've been having this argument with some of my true believer friends where I said, well, listen, if we're having female enlisted Marines pass that standard, why is there such a delta between the enlisted standard and the officer standard?
Exactly. And that's another great question. I don't know why there is.
Yeah, you get that answer of, well, you got to lead from the front. I'm like, okay, I get that. But we should have a metric that everybody's held to, not just like, let's make it hard. Because it seems to me that we're making IOC, like you said, let's just make it hard enough until we kick out all the people that we don't want.
I was at IOC this past November speaking to a class there, and I was invited because one of the former Marines in my rifle platoon who went on to be a officer is now a instructor at IOC. And so I came to talk to his class, and he and I were having a conversation on the side just about how things had maybe changed since I went through, then since when he went through. And he was just making the point to me, you know, that they are really, as instructors, under a microscope there because of this one issue of gender integration and women passing through in a way that, from his understanding, people never were there in the past and certainly didn't seem the case when I was there. So, you know, so this has changed a lot of the schools. But, you know, but again, I mean, I think at the end of the day, the central question is the Corps should set these standards. They should determine what the standard is going to be. They should hold everybody to the standard. And then, you know, let females pass into it, let males pass in through it. I mean, that's the only way to do this health, you know, in a healthy way. And I don't think there's any woman that I've heard who's advocating for a reduction of standards to admit women. I think most women understand that the only way you're going to gain acceptance into these units is to pass the same standard as the men. And I think the men should look at this as a great opportunity to reset standards and hold people to them, because it really matters now in a way that it doesn't before because of all the tensions around gender integration. So in some ways, there's an opportunity here. And speaking with some of the first female infantry Marines, you know, they just want to do their jobs. And the one wrinkle I would add to it too, James, it's sort of absurd. You know, I covered the war in Syria. If you look at the people who are fighting our wars right now, I mean, we're sort of in a peacetime Marine Corps at this point, by and large. But, you know, look in Syria, right, outside of Raqqa, which is now the next major battle that's going to go on in the Syrian civil war, the U.S. surrogates are the Kurds, as represented by the YPG. And the Kurds fight in fully integrated male-female combat units. Completely central to who they are. So the surrogates who are fighting ISIS for us in the greatest numbers have women amongst their ranks fighting in combat jobs to include their infantry. So this is not impossible to do, but it's just going to take, it will take organizational shifts in culture. And in order to do that successfully, it will take very clear leadership from the top of the organization, you know, as well as from the bottom, but definitely from the top. And I think we didn't see that leadership up until now. I think we are seeing it now. Post-Marines United, it's just sad that this had to happen in order for there to be some leadership on it.
And I think there's something really key in that you mentioned. One of your former Marines is now an officer. The other one's a reporter. Our young Marines, they might be knuckleheads sometimes, but they are bright people, and they get those cues. One of the problems I think we have is you can't just have a male general addressing this all the time.
I agree with that too, but you know, there's also sort of larger questions about, you know, like, why is this happening now, right? Like, there were these questions of integration in 2011, 2012, 2013. Why now? And I think you do look, you know, when you look at the history of America's wars, one thing that's very typical is there's a drawdown in these conflicts, whether it's like, for instance, after the Second World War, when, you know, the U.S. military was completely demobilized and sort of in disarray a little bit and undermanned. You know, that's when you had North Korea invaded South Korea, and you almost had U.S. troops, you know, overrun and pushed out of the Pusan perimeter in South Korea. You know, you look at the military post-Vietnam. I mean, you know, legendary lapses in morale and discipline in the early 1970s. The U.S. military was broken. You know, and you look now, you have at this moment, I mean, we still have our sort of war simmering, but by and large, most Marines, unlike a decade ago, aren't just re-upping and going into combat zones. And so I think you might be seeing as well another sort of dip in discipline and morale. And it's tough being in the Marine Corps when you don't have the clarifying purpose of a war to fight.
Right.
You know, when you know that in 4 months or 5 months, your battalion's heading to Ramadi and you're going to be fighting and slugging out in the streets there, you kind of don't have time to be like, dorking off and posting nudie photos on the internet. You know, you're about to do some real stuff. But, you know, but maybe if you know that, listen, the next 6 months for me is marking time in Okinawa, you know, you might have different challenges in your unit. And I think part of this is
idle hands being
exactly. You're seeing a certain amount of idleness. It's you know, one of the Marines I talked to, this guy Brennan McDonald, who did some pretty, in my opinion, outrageous stuff online, stalking this woman, borderline criminal stuff, and we'll see what happens. When I taught him, I was like, what were you thinking? He just kind of said, you know, I don't know, Marines are going to do dumb shit. That's what he actually said to me. Yeah. I mean, this guy had no concept of his actions and, you know, how devastating they were for this, you know, for this female Marine. But having spent a lot of time around Marines, I don't doubt that part of it was, yeah, he just didn't know. You know, just wasn't self-aware enough. And I think part of it is kind of coming from, as you mentioned, those idle hands.
And the fact that his prefrontal cortex hasn't fully formed because he hasn't hit age 24 or 5. So.
Well, and what's strange, this guy, I think, is 25 or 26. He's actually joined the Corps a little bit later. But regardless, I think, you know, we are also, as much as the Corps is wrestling with these issues of gender integration, the Corps is also wrestling with the fact that it is a post-war Marine Corps now. You're on that sort of a little bit on that drawdown. And how do we refocus the minds of these Marines? And you might say, well, you know, a lot of these Marines, they weren't in the war. It's like you're refocusing their minds. This is the only Corps they knew. But some of them have come into the Corps, I think, and have experienced this amongst Marines I talked to with, they've seen the Marine Corps fighting wars now for a decade, and they've come in and they've expected to have those experiences of combat, intense combat, and they haven't gotten that.
Right. Military Justice is brought to you by the good people of Betterment. Betterment is the largest independent online financial advisor. The service is designed to help improve customers' long-term returns while lowering taxes for retirement planning, building wealth, and other financial goals. Betterment takes advanced investment strategies and uses technology to deliver them to more than 250,000 customers. Now you may be asking, why should I choose Betterment over my current investment platform? For one, personalized advice for your financial planning needs. Based on the information you tell us, we make tailored recommendations on decisions like how much to invest, how much risk to take in your portfolio, and the type of investment account you should have. Or advice that looks at all of your wealth. Betterment gives you a clear view of your net worth when you sync your outside accounts, such as bank accounts and other investments. We show you how much your outside brokerage accounts are costing you in fees and uninvested cash. Now, investing involves risk, and that's true even if you do use Betterment. But listeners of this podcast can get up to 1 year managed free. Yes. That's a free year of investment advice. For more information, visit betterment.com/military. Betterment, rethink what your money can do. Again, for that free year, go to betterment.com/military.
You know, why do people bully? You know, any bully, right, usually their bullying is a manifestation of some type of inadequacy they feel, and they take it out on somebody else.
Right.
And so some of this machismo around this new photo sharing stuff, and I'm never going to, you know, let women, they can't serve in my core. You know, I start to ask the question, like, you know, what's your hang up, guy? Like, what are you feeling so insecure about that you need to bully this woman? You know, are you feeling insecure about what you've done in the Marine Corps? You know, is that what this is about? And if this woman is in your unit, it takes something away from you?
I think that's definitely at the core.
Yeah, I mean, you just look at it, this is bullying.
Yeah, so, and this isn't, I think that people and politicians sometimes think that, well, just some tweaks to the UCMJ and we're going to be fine. But if you take the central female Marine that you cover in your story, I mean, she's kind of being stalked around and photographs are being taken of her. It's hard to criminalize that. I mean, I'm not saying that it's, but just speaking from my prosecutor, putting on my prosecutor hat, that's not an easy thing to, it's bad behavior, but to say it's criminal behavior is a little bit difficult.
Well, I'll defer to you because I'm not a lawyer, but I know that when this first broke, the Corps sort of was struggling to understand how do we respond to this. And I think NCIS as well was like, what do you prosecute this under? I know that's been one of the challenges. And one of the things that's also been difficult is some of this, you know, bullying has gone on amongst people who are no longer active duty Marines, right, and so aren't even prosecutable under the UCMJ. So they can be doing this stuff. And then it's very difficult to prosecute.
Well,
so,
and I want to get at what was your feeling talking with her? Because you do a good job of sketching it out, but anything that didn't make it into the article? Because even when she's checking in and getting her first gear issue, there's people, or at least one Marine, taking photographs of her at kind of every turn.
Yeah, I think that this is someone who joined the Marine Corps, wanted to have that experience, wanted to serve their country, wanted to deploy, and has had a really terrible experience and hasn't felt like they've been welcomed into an organization, even though they've met all of the standards. And I think it's sad. I think it's the Marine Corps' loss. I think they're going to, you know, I think she'll finish out her stint in the Corps, but I doubt she'll reenlist and the Corps loses a good person.
Yeah, and that wasn't, not just because the technology wasn't here, but that was never a worry for me. You know, I never, like, oh my God, it's, you know, it's somebody taking photos of me as, you know, as I'm getting a gear issue. That's, or or I'm going to the chow hall or at the gym. That just wasn't never something that crossed my mind in the Marine Corps.
Right. And, you know, I talk a little bit about Savannah Cunningham in the article, who was a woman who had her photos posted, and she was a poolee. She hadn't even come into the Corps yet. And right. So, you know, Thomas was the one who first spoke to her. And, you know, Thomas said to me, and I agree with him, he's like, it's like the ultimate welcome to the family when you hadn't even joined the Corps yet. And now already your photos are online. It's sort of the ultimate intimidation of like, this is what it's about. And, you know, and I thought about that, like, you know, what is in our culture? Like, for instance, you know, I got married and I had a sword arch, right? So what do you do? I don't know. Are you married?
Yeah. Yeah. There's that little tap. Yeah.
Right. So tell, you tell me what's the thing you do with the sword arch, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And what do you do to the bride at the end of the sword arch?
She tapped on the behind.
Yeah. You swipe her on the ass with your Mameluke sword or the blade of your NCO sword. And you say, welcome to the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
Like that's the ceremony. And I that happened at my wedding and I never thought twice about it. I thought it was sort of a nice, funny ceremony, but like, if that's the organization, and you know, that's fine if you have one type of organizational culture that's all male in the most hallowed bastions of the culture, which are like the infantry and the combat arms, and it's all male, and you know, it's all well and good. But when it stops being all male, you know, what signal does that, like, what are we saying if that's what we still do? I'm not a particularly, you know, febile, politically correct guy, but I think, you know, you have to say, all right, how do we re-engineer this thing so that people don't just think this is okay, and we don't have a Corps that's completely out of step with society? Because at the end of the day, you know, in all the services represent the society that they come from, and they have to evolve if that society evolves. And it seems as though the society has, because the Marine Corps has these marching orders. So
this
is on the leadership to figure this out.
I really love the point that you've been making about in our kind of post-war drawdowns, this always happens. And if we go back to post-World War II, 5 years later, they're holding hearings about racial integration, and the Marine Corps was defending its policy when we had one black Marine officer. And they were saying right. That this is a good policy.
And well, and you know, if you look at the Vietnam era, where it was sort of like acceptable to like smoke dope in the ranks, and everyone did it, and it wasn't that big of a deal. You know, I can only speak for myself. Like when I was in the Corps, you know, it was, you know, there was zero tolerance. For drugs. And culturally, I mean, you would have a drug pop here or there in the infantry, but culturally, I mean, guys knew you do not go there. And I think the Marine Corps just has to understand that, like, you don't go there on this stuff either.
Yeah, and listen, I'm maybe not as attuned to this because I'm a white dude, but I didn't feel a lot of racial tension in my career in the Marine Corps.
Neither did I.
I mean, I definitely didn't feel it outward, I mean, or coming to me, but it seemed that we all got along pretty well, especially when, you know, forced, you know, to do something important. So For some reason, our general officers aren't good barometers of determining the impact that change will have on the organizations.
But, you know, but it's where I'm optimistic because I think the organizations have always been here before. You know, it's always been a little bit grating in the early days, and there is always the correction. And I do think it's unfortunate that the Marine Corps' leadership couldn't intuit the challenge that this would be and how significant it would be. And so we've had this incident. I do feel that the organization gets it, like they got the message. And I think that the Marine Corps and the other services will manage to successfully navigate this. I'm sure there will be other instances along the way. I'll say, digging into this article, talking to a lot of people, I think there are still some knuckleheads who don't get it and who are going to be a thorn in the side. But I think the organization gets it and is going to send the message down into the ranks that this is not acceptable.
Yeah, that's good to know, because I'll tell you, you know, just looking at it from, you know, you get stuck in this, but like this court, you know, if I'm a prosecutor, even if you convict a guy of doing this, not necessarily the revenge porn, that's easier to criminalize. But some of this other just caddish behavior, that to try to change that through courts martial, and even this, the first court martial we had was a summary. It's really an administrative issue. It's not actually, in reality, it's not even part of your criminal record. So the idea that we're going to, you know, send a lot of people to jail to change this, I think is wrong. So it's good to know that we're having organizational change, and that instructors and leaders and staff NCOs and officers are going to change this.
And I think what you're going to see too is that the greatest forces of change on this issue are going to be the women themselves who come into these units and successfully perform. That's going to be the single greatest thing. You know, I think that, you know, when I talk to civilians and they ask about the Marine Corps, if this issue ever comes up, the thing that always sort of blows them away is when I tell them, you know, I was 31 years old before I ever had a colleague that was a female, right? Before I ever went to an office or sat down with a woman in the office. And they sort of can't believe that. I said, well, you know, I was in the infantry and I was in special operations. There were no women allowed. There was no female admin officer. There was no female logistics officer, none of that. So, I mean, I would see female Marines, but I never worked with one until I was, you know, 31 years old.
Yeah, so after TBS, and, it stopped for years for you. For a decade.
Not just for me, for anyone who was in combat arms. Yes. So I think that as, you know, women come in and, you know, you have female machine gunners and female mortarmen and female, you know, infantry officers, you know, that they're going to be the ones who do the most to change the tone, because it's going to be difficult for guys if they've worked with a real professional who's a female to take the position that, oh, well, they just can't do it, because they can point to an example and say, well, look at her, she's doing it, or look at her, she just, you know, beat me in my last PFT, or can do, you know, disassembly and assembly on a, you know, on a 240 Golf 10 seconds faster than I can. That's going to be the biggest change that comes.
Well, that's good. That's good to know. I don't want to take up too much more of your time. You've been really generous with me today. Tell us about that next book that's coming out.
You know, the next one that comes out is sort of a very, it's one of my most, I would say, personal book. And it's about a guy who is unconscious in a hospital down in San Antonio. And it's about him kind of slowly regaining consciousness. But I haven't started talking about it as much. So it's always difficult to take a book and condense it down to a paragraph. And so maybe we'll have a conversation again once I've honed it into my paragraph and can speak a little more eloquently on the subject. But I'm looking forward to having it out.
Yeah. And please ping me. I'd love to have you back on to talk about it, because I can't recommend enough Dark at the Crossing. It was a great read, and you really do an exceptional job of capturing individuals.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that you enjoyed it, and thanks for having me on.
Hey, where can my listeners follow you?
I'm at Elliot Ackerman on Twitter, and I'm www.elliotackerman.com online.
Great. I will put those both in the show notes. I can't thank you enough, Elliot. Military Justice is a production of Long Arc Digital Media. There are numerous people that need to be thanked for making Military Justice possible. First of all, audio. Those are the people that clean up all the mistakes I made. Hannah McCarthy, she takes care of that. Methil Telhan, she takes care of everything. She keeps the show moving along and keeps all of us on schedule. Executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You know him from Undisclosed and The Wearing of Underwear. And as always, Uber producer Dreadnought has my six.